outside the backstage door to breathe some nicotine. And maybe check my mailbox, see if I can read the screen. Then I heard a click, the stage door lock. I knew just what that meant. I'm gonna have to walk around the block if I wanna get in. A wristband, my man, you got to have a wristband. If you don't have a wristband, my man, you don't get through the door. Wristband, my man, you got to have a wristband. If you don't have a wristband, my man, you don't get through the door.
And welcome to The News. We're down in New Haven right now. The voice that you hear is that of Paul Simon. His 13th album, 13th solo album, has dropped today, just a few hours ago. Stranger to Stranger, his brand new album, joined the world. So we thought we would talk about it today. It's especially poignant for me because I'm down here for my 40th reunion at college. I'm here with one of our guests on the panel, Kevin Kane, who I haven't seen, I think, in 40 years. But Kevin is a musician whose rock career spans 45 years, which is nothing to Paul Simon. That's why we wanted to talk about Paul Simon, so we wouldn't feel old today. Paul Simon's Sound of Silence came out 52 years ago. So Kevin's here in studio to do that with us. Mercy Quay is back. She's a director of communications for New Haven Public Schools, and which she started the day before yesterday.
Yep, Wednesday.
Right. A lot of changes around here. And then a pillar of stability for us, Brian Slattery, is arts editor for the New Haven Independent. Why would that be inherently funny? Brian Slattery.
It's the first time anybody's ever called me stable.
Well, it could start a trend. And he's a producer at WNHH Radio. So this is Paul Simon's, as I say, 13th album. This is, I should just let you guys sort of maybe even just react a little bit. I'll set the stage so that you can sort of swat tennis balls back at me. For me, I've been kind of waiting for him to make this album. The last three that he's done, I mean, I own them, I listen to them occasionally, but they really haven't sort of penetrated. They haven't ginned up the kind of excitement in me that say Rhythm of the Saints back in 1990 did, or Graceland before it. This one, I think, comes closer to doing that, and I'm really looking forward to spending even a lot more time with it. We've all been kind of delving into it and probing around in it. So, but I want to hear from you guys. I know, Brian, you didn't have quite as rapturous a reaction to it as I did. That you rejected it.
Yeah, right. I was going to say, it's not an album that I think anybody would hate. It'd be hard to hate the album. I couldn't even imagine like what the criteria would
There's
be.
There's a
for
person out
that.
There.
Yeah, maybe. You know, but it's mostly that, you know, it's more or less what I would expect from Paul Simon at this point. You know, there's the let's muck around with like some music from other cultures and see what interesting things we can, you know, see what interesting things we can put together. And it's all sort of delivered still with the same kind of like, he has this way of delivering his lines that's like very laid back. Mm-hmm. And it's something that he's always done sort of regardless of what's going on around him musically. And you know, that's still doing what it's doing. So like it was, you know, it's all sort of like really well done, and you know, the musicianship is pretty impeccable. But at the same time, I didn't find myself like surprised by anything, and nor did it make me stop. I admit that I was making dinner while I was listening to the album, but sometimes if I'm doing that, I end up not making dinner because I end up just listening to whatever it is I put on, and that didn't happen. I just finished making dinner.
All right, that could be. They should start testing things that way.
But you know, it was That was about it.
So, Kevin, I know you have lots to say about this, and as somebody who was, I mean, I should say Kevin was an active rock musician back in the mid-1970s when we were living here in New Haven. He staged a rock opera that he'd probably rather I didn't bring up, but but I mean, Paul Simon must have just animated kind of your musical life as few other people with that kind of continuity.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty interesting that you did bring up the rock opera, so I'm forced to sort of, you know, confront that period of time. And there were some sort of Simon-esque songs on there. But, you know, for somebody like me and, of course, Colin, in our age group, you know, he's so seminal. And that voice, you know, a lot of people say it doesn't have a lot of range, it's kind of thin. All of those things are true, but it's the perfect vehicle for his intelligent, sophisticated, wry lyric line. And, you know,
for sure.
So when I kind of looked at it, when I heard it, I think it's terrific. And this is on the fifth listening. I had three more times while I was driving up here. And for me alone, Proof of Life, The Insomniac's Lullaby, you know, I would just take those songs and put them up against his best work. I did bring his book, you know, so I have all the all the lyrics. I put that up against his best work, and I think he's been able to take his sound and his what he used to use in a rhythmic sort of rhythm picking, folk picking way. That's been supplanted by some wonderful instrumentation and some really vibrant stuff. So I think he's grown, yet he's still in the vein that you want from Paul Simon. I like the fact that I wasn't surprised, by the way. I think I'm really happy about that. You know,
as you get older, you start to relish surprises. You want less of that.
Yeah.
There are fewer good surprises.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't want to hear Billy Joel play guitar. Not really. Okay. So, you know.
So, Mercy, a lot of the themes on this album are themes about which you so far don't know very much, which have to do with growing old. I mean, it's sort of there. It's a lot of what he's talking about right now. But I'm also just interested, as somebody who is far younger, whether Paul Simon resonates at all with you, and if so, whether this particular release does.
Yeah, I can say that in order to sort of inform my opinion about this album, I had to ask my not so much peers. I've had to ask people, you know, who's Paul
just
Simon?
Old people on the street, basically.
I wasn't going to say that. Although I did ask my grandma, and I...
Oh, this is really getting worse.
No, I'm feeling better.
And I've asked a couple people. I've asked a former teacher of mine, Justin Boucher, who's going to be ecstatic that I said his name on the radio just now. You know, who Paul Simon is and how I should feel, and is this a typical album for him? And then I sort of took that and informed my opinion when I was sort of listening. And I don't say this often. In fact, I say it fairly infrequently. But, you know, with the mixture of cultural sounds that he combines to create this album, if this doesn't end racism, I'm not sure what will.
I'm sure the people at Concord Records are going to use that as a blurb somehow or other. For people who want to hear a little bit more of it, Kevin mentioned the cut Proof of Love, which at the moment for me is the one that I'm ready to delve deepest into. So let's hear a little bit of Paul Simon, Proof of Love.
Begin again, no easy trick, without a guide or walking stick. Begin before the bells of twilight. Downhill town, the road ahead, spiral as a serpent's bed. A teaspoon of desire for my meal. I trade my tears to ask the Lord for proof of love. If
I'd love to play more of that for you, but then we wouldn't get to talk. So, Kevin, one of the things that makes playing little clips from this album difficult is that he really has strayed away a lot from kind of A-B bridge structure. A lot of times these compositions, they have movements in them, rather. So this doesn't really necessarily stay in one place or follow a very conventional melodic structure, which can either be disorienting or pleasurable. I'm finding it very pleasurable on a lot of these cuts.
Yeah, so am I. And at first I was thinking of them as vignettes, that kind of separate pieces that were tied together. But when you listen to it in its entirety, and it's the only way to listen to this album, I mean, you have to go song to song to song. Those vignettes are so interesting. The beginnings of each song is so interesting. And lots of times the melody in the verses, he's changing that around at the same time. But those lyrics are just so clever. You just can't get away.
Brian, one thing that you said was that you wanted this music to... We've been emailing about this album. You wanted this to explode more. You wanted... because Paul Simon is famous for having, in the making of Graceland, having gone to South Africa and worked with musicians there and then brought them over here to work with him some more, and then going to Brazil for Rhythm of the Saints.
Right.
But you want the rhythms here, all the kind of polyrhythmic stuff that's going on in this particular album, to do something more than it's doing.
Yeah. I think very long story short, the debt that I owe to Paul Simon is being a kid when Graceland came out and really liking the sound of the album and being like, at the time, just a little baby musician going, how did he come up with all of this? It opened the door, along with like a few other artists who had done this. It opened the door to like the world of African and South American music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I walked through and have not really stopped walking. So there's a huge debt that I owe to this guy for that. But that said, now that it's been, 30 years of of listening to that stuff, when I come back, what I want is more of the excitement that I hear in those actual African and South American records,
mm-hmm.
Which do tend to be like a little harder hitting, more dynamic range. And even when the singer is pretty laid back, there's a certain element of like engagement that Paul Simon doesn't do. So, when he employs those rhythms, like my expectations are that at some point I want to make sure that everybody's dancing, and that never quite happens.
Your body language is suggesting you wanted to say something.
Well, no, I think that's, that was the interesting part of the email thread this week. And I really hadn't thought about it that way, because I look at Paul Simon as 50 years of songwriter. And so for me, what he brings to the emotional equation is what he decides to write about. And if he's talking about proof of love, now I'm thinking about it. And, his elegance in getting me to think about things all the way back to American Tune, you can go keep going back on. And so when I look at him as a songwriter, I look at his topics and what he's choosing to muse about.
Mm-hmm.
And then that he surrounded himself with difference in musicians, I think is pretty cool. And if I want to...
Sure.
Oh, really
yeah.
cool.
And yeah, absolutely.
But if I want to dance, I'll definitely go to someone who I think has that trick,
Right, this isn't...
Any Prince song, tee it up,
Right.
Right, exactly. This isn't by any means your typical jukebox album. This is a cooking... Right? The first date cooking in the kitchen, make it all through the way through dinner.
And there's
album.
A place in the world for this.
Right. Absolutely.
Definitely.
I'll probably put it on when I go to my yoga class. Right. And I think there is a place for that. I think I am incredibly appreciative of artists who incorporate these sounds, artists who, highlight Peruvian drums, right? Or, what have you. And I think there's something to be said about this. Someone called it a genre bending album,
mm-hmm.
Which is sort of interesting because at the same time, it's not incredibly innovative for Paul Simon, as I understand.
From old people.
As I've been told. but, when I hear the word genre bending, I'm thinking, I don't know, Childish Gambino, right? I'm thinking Prince. I'm thinking, help me out here, To Pimp a Butterfly, Kendrick Lamar.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of those sort of
Kendrick
sounds.
Kendrick Lamar. I feel like a really old guy now.
I got quiet all of a sudden.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I like that D'Angelo fella, too. He's very nice. Well, yeah, actually, before we continue, and I want to come back to that in a second. I think you're making a really interesting point here. But once again, just to give people the flavor of this a little bit more, and I'll set this up. Some of the narrative of this album seems to flow through the mind of somebody other than Paul Simon, this persona that he's created, somebody he called the Street Angel. This is pretty obviously a kind of schizophrenic man that would be panhandling out on the street, maybe showing up at the ER at another point. This is the song, Street Angel.
My heart goes out to the street angels working their way back home. My heart goes out to the street angels. I saved my change for a street angel working his way back home. I had this exchange with the street angel.
Nobody talks to me much.
I said, nobody talks to me much. Nobody. So he says, I make my verse for the universe. I write my rhymes for the university.
See, Mercy, this, you know, what Brian said earlier may actually wreck this album for me, which is too bad because I was really enjoying it. But and that is, I mean, so Simon, what Simon has done his entire career is inhabit a lot of things. He kind of, he's like a hermit crab, right? He goes in and he takes somebody else's shell, you know? And so with Graceland, there were a lot of people who were somewhat critical of him, partly because there was still a boycott going on of a lot of things South African. But he thought that he could play a better role by working with those musicians. But he became that hermit crab, right? He moved into their shell. Some people thought that was great in terms of introducing it to the West and to Americans. There are other people who thought it was a lot of cultural appropriation. Some similar criticisms, maybe not as bad with Rhythm of the Saints. But, you know, Brian's, the thing that Brian said, that where he doesn't necessarily move in with full conviction. I don't know, I'm not exactly paraphrasing.
No, that's fair.
So I'm listening to this thing now and I'm thinking, well, in some ways this is a really interesting attempt to approximate the mental state of a schizophrenic. And so there's, all through this thing, there's found tape and there's stuff played backwards and there's mechanical noises, and supposedly Simon and his compatriots built or invented some new rhythmic instruments for some of these songs. So, but now I'm concerned that it's right. Artifice as opposed to conviction.
Sure. I mean, I think there is a word for this, Columbusing. It's great. So a conversation I had about this earlier was that, you know, it is great to sort of use your platform as a known artist and sort of incorporate these other sounds and other artists and sort of get them some notoriety as well. If that's what you're doing, great. But there's some space to be to have a conversation about whether this is appreciation or appropriation. And, you know, I can't answer that question, right? And I think anytime the conversation of whether something is appreciative or appropriative, I don't think the answer is as cut and dry as this. I think, you know, whatever that answer may be, it is awesome because, well, it being this album is awesome in the regard that it does, like Brian said, open the door to these sounds to people who would otherwise not hear it. I sometimes take issue to the idea, you know, statements like, oh, no one even knows, or New Haven's most kept secret, or that kind of thing, because it's like, to who, right? It sort of discounts.
Somebody knows.
Exactly.
So we should say Columbusing is when you discover the Argentinian restaurant that the Argentine community has been going to in your city for 10 years, but you've just discovered it.
Exactly.
And so, you know, but Brian, that what she's talking about is, it is the dilemma of Paul Simon, right? That you were growing
absolutely
up in upstate New York,
right?
Unlikely to have encountered Ladysmith Mambazo,
right?
In any other context. I mean, part of the problem
certainly
is
certainly not then, and certainly not before then,
right?
Right.
I mean, sometimes if somebody doesn't, I mean, there were certainly South African musicians who, they weren't using that word, but they were accusing Paul Simon of Columbusing, saying, oh,
for
we
sure.
needed him to discover us.
For sure.
But Americans probably wouldn't have, you know?
And
I mean, at the time, like, the audience for African music in the United States was tiny. It was really, really small.
Mm.
And it's a lot bigger now. And there are lots of things that played into that. But certainly Paul Simon was a part of that. You know, it's like he got Ladysmith's Black Mambazo on Saturday Night Live. You know, it's like that's pretty neat. You know, and it's like you can, there's a lot to be said about, you know, what his relationship with the music is. But that break is a break, you know.
And Kevin, this is something that Brian has talked about a lot on the show in the past, is that what musicians do anyway is incorporate everything that they've ever heard, right? That, you know, it's rare. It's rare. There's that everybody wants to be wildly original, but nobody's ever wildly original in a way that completely forsakes everything that's piled up in their heads.
Well, Yoko Ono was wildly original.
That's such an unfair way.
And I'm not sure how that worked out. So, yeah, you know, it's an amalgamation. It's an accumulation of who you've worked with and sort of, you know, as a songwriter, though, as you're coursing through decade after decade, it should be stronger. You should your songs and your your topics and your musicianship should be stronger. I don't look at Paul Simon as a musician. I look at him as a songwriter. So I don't hold him too accountable for playing those parts. But one thing that does bother me about the album is that I think that you start to fall in love with digital stuff and you become sort of the digerati of producers. And there's too much stuff in there that maybe if you simplified it, the emotion would come through. Edie song with his guitar, right? Mm-hmm. It's an interlude, but how emotional is just that guitar? And it's not, I'll say at this point, mucked up with other stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes when you get in that producing role, you're really throwing kitchen sinks in when sometimes you don't need to. And I think that's one of the songs I think is a problem.
So less is more sometimes. Let's hear one of the many fabulously cluttered songs here. This is called, I'm just going in order right now, but let's hear Werewolf.
Milwaukee man led a fairly decent life, made a fairly decent living, had a fairly decent wife. She killed him, sushi knife. Now they're shopping for a fairly decent afterlife. Most old bits are mixed reviews. Life is a lottery. A lot of people lose, and the winners, the grinners.
So, I mean, Mercy, to Kevin's point, there's a lot of things that happen in the first few bars of that, right? I mean, we're hearing rhythm, we're hearing electronics, we're hearing wolf howls, we're hearing. But maybe to a young person, that's just the way music sounds.
Yeah, I mean, was there something wrong with this? This is how music sounds. I'm not sure. Earlier I wanted to say I am familiar with Yoko Ono. I believe I've heard that name before once or twice. And
around the grandfather table.
Right. around the cooler. Is that a saying? I don't know what you guys used to say. But
you're getting it.
But I will say, when you think about busy sounds like this, I think about Kanye West doing everything he can to sound original, right? And I mean, if we're talking about Paul Simon trying to reinvigorate his sound and make music for 2016, this is acceptable. Mm-hmm. This makes sense. There were moments where I didn't understand the beat and I couldn't sort of pick up on the rhythm because I felt that the way he was singing to the rhythm behind him didn't exactly match, which gives me this anxiety that makes me dislike the song. And so I have to stop listening or skip to the next one at that point. But besides that, I think it being busy is appropriate for the time.
Mm. He's always kind of polyrhythmic, right? And time signatures are, who knows what they even are. I don't know if you guys could figure those things out. Sometimes even keys seemed a little...
We'd have to separate those tracks out.
Yeah. So one of the things that we heard in Werewolf, Brian, was an artist called Clap Clap. And first of all, before we even get to Clap Clap, I love the thing that you said about what you would do if you had an afternoon with Paul Simon Simon had to do whatever you wanted.
I mean, the thing is, like you were saying, Mercy, I mean, he gets huge points for not just doing what he was doing in 1970.
Yeah.
Right? It's really cool that you get the sense that he's a guy who is always listening to new music. Like, he's always interested in what's going on around him. And, I was saying to Colin that, like, if I had, like, 4 hours with Paul Simon, I would just want to hang out with him and, like, have him play me records that he really likes. And talk about them because, like with Graceland, like with this album now, my first thought is like, well, I just became a fan of Clap Clap, the guy who who did like the backing tracks to two of the songs on it because I love them. And then sure enough, he's great.
Yeah. So here's a little bit of The Rainstick Fable by Clap Clap. So that's really cool. But what Clap Clap can't... Clap Clap's, I think, an Italian artist, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Italian artist. But Kevin, what Clap Clap can't do there is put a soul in a human face and a recognizable narrative into that. That's sort of Paul Simon's right. contribution.
Correct. You said it way better than. in fact, I was going to say that exactly the same, but it was. No, again, I think Paul's contribution to the song, you know, the other musicians are serving the song. Paul's contribution is to write the bones of it, get the emotion, the spirit out of it. And if his musicians are serving him well, that song is going to do where they take it. And usually that should be better. And that's what I think the talent of a songwriter is. And what I was trying to say earlier is that sometimes the songwriter and the musicians are really cool together and the producer gets in the way and just layers it with too much stuff. Mm-hmm. And so the honesty of his lyrics, I mean, how can you just begins with Werewolf. That's a killer first two lines. Yeah. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, that's Paul's contribution. And if the other musicians take that to any number of fans, I just think that's great.
Before we ran out of time, Kevin, one of the great points that I thought you made as we were emailing around is, you know, Brian, I think, occasionally hears something a little bit languid and casual in the way that Paul Simon sings or enunciates some of these words. You hear it a little bit differently. You hear a guy who picks out words that sound very natural for him to sing.
He selects syllables that sing well. Mm-hmm. And I think that influences his lyrical choice. And, you know, I kind of made a joke that, you know, how can you sing the word jittery and make that work, right? But I think lots of open vowels, and I just think that lends to that languid sort of thing that I happen to like, and it just helps his voice all the way through, but he selects them.
Well, we now do have to stop, but we're going to end with, first of all, I'm going to say we're going to come back with more of this great panel, and we're going to talk about problems at the zoo with gorillas. We're going to be talking also about, if we have time, about the Yale English Department, because that's always, you know, they're always in the news, right? But we are we ending with Insomniac's Lullaby? No, you're ending with something else. All right.
High school is closed, same for the local police. Shall we tearfully embrace? Shall we sing Amazing Grace? Will the shallow river waters bring us peace? Army dude, only son, nowhere to run. No one to turn to, he turns to the gun. It's a cross, it's a stone, it's a fragment of bone. It's a long walk home. A long walk home. Gonna be a long walk home from the riverbank.
And are we back? We are back. So I'm down in the New Haven studios, and I have to be honest with you. I'm never quite on solid ground here in the New Haven studios. They're all set up differently, and I'm often dazed and confused, even more so than usual. And that may be amplified by the fact that I'm down here for my 40th college reunion. Kevin Kane, who went to college with me, is one of our guests on the nose today. Also, Brian Francis Slattery and Mercy Quay. And we're going to talk about a story that you're probably borderline sick of at this point. One of the things we love to do on the nose, actually, is have a conversation about something that you're really tired of hearing about, but I think we might have just caught it while it still has the capacity to excite. Of course, I'm talking about what happened last Saturday, May 28th. A 4-year-old boy slipped inside the habitat called Gorilla World at the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden. You know the story well by now, but he climbed through a barrier, fell 15 feet into a shallow moat where a 17-year-old Western lowland gorilla named Harambe found him. There was video of the incident. We see Harambe dragging the boy, grabbing him by the foot, not letting him crawl away, and eventually Harambe had to be dispatched in order to rescue the boy. This has created all kinds of controversies and change.org petitions and questions about parenting styles and questions about zoo design, and everybody seems to have an opinion anyway about it. Mercy, I'll let you get us started here. I know that you've Well, I'll just let you get us started. Where should we? How do you want to begin?
Oh, okay. So I'm not sure why you started with me, because I decided that I was going to develop my opinion after hearing Brian say something cool. But
we can go back to that strategy.
I just, you know, I part of you know, my lingering opinion or my initial opinion on this has to do with a bit of the aftermath. You know, there is an entire investigation into the family, which seems absurd to me. You're looking into the family's criminal background, department or whatever. Was it Cleveland?
Cincinnati.
Cincinnati. Whatever Cincinnati's form of Department of Children's Services has gotten involved. And I'm just astounded by this, because you know what? It seems to me that people continue to go to places that are dangerous and are surprised when they get hurt, which is, you know, the basis of every Jurassic Park, Jurassic World, you know, movie, right? You go to some place that is dangerous and you're probably going to get hurt if there's, you know, not a safe exhibit, right?
And but especially if it's called Jurassic. I would never take my children right. to be called Jurassic. But I would take my children to the zoo, because I think the zoo is going to be basically safe. But
Gorilla
Kevin,
World?
Kevin, you have well, Gorilla World. Yeah, Gorilla's, you know, I think people thought that was probably pretty safe, Gorilla World. Before Kevin and I both have children who are now in their 60s or something. I don't know how they got there. But the one thing that any parent can tell you is there were five times in your child's childhood where you reached into a diaper bag and took your eyes off the kid, and the kid was, like, you know, jumping over some chasm that it was a – I mean, the notion anyway that these are bad parents because this happened, I'm having a hard time buying.
Oh, man. I'm not only a hard time buying, but it's – I mean, just shut it down. Stop talking about right. this stuff. You know, the good thing is back when we did that, we didn't have the exponential problem of social media
right.
that – you know, where you bring the entire galleries of peanut gallery folks, and they're all chipping in, from the people that say, okay, one gorilla, one kid, gorilla dead every time. I mean, do we really need that, you know? For the people who are indicting the parents on their parenting skills, there's an inquisition into how they've been raising their child and how that could end up in a 15-foot fall. Do we really need that? I mean, I just think it's such a bloated story. I guess they're building the fences higher mm-hmm. as a result. That's more of an insurance thing than it is probably anything else. But I believe we've caught this story right at the height of its awareness on social media. And I just don't think I have a whole lot to add, except for I think that we all ought to probably not let your kid slip down there, and that's about the best.
Well, Brian, my takeaway is we don't mind if gorillas die, but not while we're watching, right? I mean, the reason that yes. there are gorilla habitats and stuff like that is because the Western Lowland gorilla is a endangered species because of a lot right. of other things.
Right. I mean, this when we were talking about it before the show, I mean, there's I feel like I'm going to be hitting like the nuclear button on this conversation, because like my.
Go right ahead.
All right.
We've been waiting for you. All right.
So the idea is that you know, I'm one of those people at this point who questions the existence of zoos at all. And
they do exist, though, actually.
I pretend that they don't. But the
that's maladaptive.
Yeah. But you know, I loved them when I was a kid. And then, you know, that sort of inspired me to want to go out into the world and see, you know, and see what the actual world was like. And I was lucky enough to be able to see a lot of animals in the wild that you would normally just see in a zoo. And then the next time I went to a zoo, it was just profoundly depressing, because you realize that, like, all of them knew they were in a zoo. And they were all just acting like you imagine, like, people in jail act. And, you know, you sort of go, well, why, you know, why are we... Why do we have these exactly? And, you know, what are we pretending? You know, what are we pretending about, like, how well the animals are treated and all of that sort of thing? And, you know, that, you know, so that, you know, when someone says, like, it's akin to what you'd said, Mercy, that you say, like, well, ultimately these are animals and you are sort of in their space.
Right.
Even when you're in a zoo.
Right.
And, you know, it's this illusion of safety is something that, like, is part of the sort of weird little lie we tell ourselves that zoos are fine. You know, when you know, I think that they're a lot more complicated and also a lot more sort of fraught than we like to think about when we're just taking our kids to them, you know. Right.
Although they can be part of a conservation strategy, too. I mean, one Absolutely. Of the problems for the Western lowland gorilla has two major problems right now. One of them is poaching. The other one is disease, and that's Ebola in particular, mm-hmm. which is probably something that humans are tracking into their habitats and stuff like that. So, I mean, one role of zoos can be, first of all, actual biological preservation, and the other can be educating people about this animal, so maybe you care about it a little bit more. I mean, zoos, I don't think they're absolutely, you know, axiomatically evil.
Well, I don't think they are either. It's just more like it's gotten a lot more complicated as I get older, that's all. You know, as opposed to, you know, the sheer delight I had when I was a child.
Right.
You
know? But, I mean, to me, that's, in the long run, there's, I mean, this is, I think, Mercy, one of the reasons that people get so overwrought about this is it's not supposed to happen. I'm not supposed to ever see this. You know, this doesn't belong in my reality. You know, if you were to tell people, well, I mean, I think 80% of this particular species is extinct. It just didn't, it's happened someplace else that you don't watch YouTube videos from.
Right. I mean, to sort of piggyback off of something Brian just mentioned, you know, we're sort of in their space. And I think part of the reason that any species ends up going extinct is because we enter their space and we sort of encroach on that. I have the same sort of theory when people get attacked in the wilderness. I mean, it's unreasonable to assume that it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. If someone came into my house and I attacked them, it would be unreasonable for someone to say, why did you attack me? And that's how I feel about, you know, what ends up happening if anyone, not even just a little kid, falls into a gorilla habitat. That's scary, right?
For sure.
We have to move on. I have other things to say about it, but they'd be much more nuclear than anything Brian said. So why do that?
No, Brian's got me going. I'm ready to go nuclear now. I'm all in.
You're in for nuclear? Okay. We have one last topic. Maybe we can get nuclear on. This is one I think that Mercy first sent over to us. And I had the wrong initial reaction to this. I didn't want to talk about it at first, and now I'm really interested. So this has been a year of protest at Yale University. Students have been upset about a lot of things, and maybe the latest thing that they are upset about, at least some of them, undergraduates are circulating a petition calling on the English department to abolish a core course requirement to study canonical writers who turn out to be all dead white poets, dead white male poets, Chaucer, Shakespeare, Milton, you know those guys, Spencer, John Donne, John Milton, Alexander Pope, William Wordsworth, T.S. Eliot. And then in the spring, I think they get to pick one modern poet. And apparently they do often pick a woman. But so the students have launched a petition calling on Yale to decolonize the course. Do you want me to have Brian say something cool so that you can react? Because I was going to go to you first. All right, then you have to go first.
I was going to use your strategy, but that's fine. Oh, my God. I wasn't ready. Okay.
Oh, you thought I was going to tee up Mercy for you. Yeah.
That's what he's been doing this whole time.
Yeah.
Well, okay, fine. So this is another thing that, like, you know, it's hard to have, like, a simple opinion about it, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, because I mean, I feel like on one level, like, all of the stuff is good, right? Mm-hmm. And then on another level, though, there is kind of, you know, it is worth asking, you know, why are certain things still canonical, mm-hmm. right? Like, I occasionally have these, like, drunk conversations with an English professor where at one point I blurted out, like, nothing is going to make me care about, like, the foibles of upper middle class British society in the 19th century. Like, I just don't care that much. You know, and then, like, that meant that I could just dispose with, like, a whole raft of novels that I was, quote-unquote, supposed to have read. Mm. And I was delighted to get rid of them and instead read a bunch of stuff that I was super into. You know, and there's something to be said for that. You know, that it's a bigger world than Britain. It's a bigger world than Europe. And, you know, occasionally I am super embarrassed by how I've read zero works of Chinese literature.
Mm.
Yeah. You know,
it's, I've not read a single thing, you know.
Kevin, I forget, what did you major in here? I've forgotten.
So has he.
Yeah.
Well, But how come I get all the tough questions? Yeah. Well, sociology and music.
Because I was trying to, I do remember when we were here that there were, every major would have core courses that you had to take. And they were pretty white male dominated too.
Oh, I mean, totally. Yeah. And I think reflective, you know, of that era. But, I agree with the conversation so far. I think it's the, I would just think from the department itself, they would want a richer, broader spectrum to teach because, I certainly hated it when I took it. And that was when the 8:30 class, because I was a freshman, I didn't know any better. So I think... well, you know what? This is, I'm just getting a phone call here. Right. I've timed out on something here. But I think that if I was going to school now, I would want a much broader description of who I could read and what was required of me. Just like the food's changed, right. all those aspects have changed, and I think it's almost on the university. Why didn't you think about this?
I think they did think about it, but I want to go to you next, and I have my own fiendish theory about this whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, last time I was here, I sort of touched very briefly on the idea of white ink and how history is written in white ink, and this is sort of, for me, reflective of that. The unfortunate thing is that we're talking about classical authors, right? And during the time that these authors were published, even if there were authors of color or women authors, there were few, number one, and number two, they weren't being published. Yeah. So, it's sifting through the what's available in that genre, it's sort of hard. But when you get to, more contemporary literature, you get into things like Zora Neale Hurston, which is awesome, right? Something that I didn't have the privilege of even reading until I was in college. But I mean, I think it's difficult because you sort of do need this holistic approach to English, to diversity in English literature. And it's sort of difficult because I'm a Black female and I'm a student an alumni of Quinnipiac who, which is a predominantly white campus, and everything around me was predominantly white, down to my food, down to my classes, down to my literature, like everything was predominantly white. And it's one of those things, the way I feel about it is, though the world wasn't like that at one point, though we weren't intentional about our inclusivity, we can be now because we know better. And to quote a Black author, Maya Angelou, when you know better, you do better.
Here's my quick take on, I could go on about this for hours, it turns out. But this is something that Yale struggled with for decades and decades and decades. And colleges have struggled for decades and decades and decades. But there's a subtext to it, which is that one of the few things that's probably more endangered than a Western lowland gorilla is the English major in college, right? The humanities are in a lot of trouble. They seem less relevant in general. STEM is kind of taking over in terms of career paths. The English major doesn't really get you very far. And then colleges made it worse by intellectually pricing themselves out of the market in the 80s and 90s with Lacanian theory, deconstruction, Foucault, all this stuff that really made it look kind of no fun to be an English major. I mean, not only were you unemployable, but you didn't even have any fun for 4 years.
You were also unintelligible.
Yeah, you're unintelligible. You were just doing this thing that really wasn't great. So as they look at it now, I think making this stuff marketable and interesting should be very much on their minds. And I'm sort of two minds about this. One of them is that since 1972, Yale's had a comparative literature major. And in comp lit, you do all the things we're talking about, right? You pull from lots of different sources. You go non-canonical. You get outside that white European canon and you do lots of interesting things with it. But on the other hand, reading some of the comments from Harold Bloom and some of the other great dons of the English department here, boy, a lot of them are just—they really are just sticking to the playbook. They're just saying,
yeah,
this is it. It's Ezra Pound, and if you don't like it, you can shut up.
I am occasionally surprised at I feel like my argument for reading, widely boils down to don't you want to read, things that are interesting?
Yeah.
The wider a net you cast, the more interesting things you can find.
I think you gave up on interesting a long time ago. All right, we have to take a break so you'll have time to make some recommendations. We'll do that after this.
What'd you learn in college, Hezzy? That's what I learned in college.
Stay with us. Colin in the Nose will be back with some recommendations. Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and our intern is Leah Myers. The part of Bill Curry was played by Art Garfunkel. We put up audio of the show, backstage gossip, and Betsy Kaplan's recipe for three bean salad on our new Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page. Come find us and give us your recipe for four bean salad. On Monday's show, we may be talking about libertarians and the launch of the new Bill Simmons website, The Ringer. And now, back to Colin.
We're back. This is The Nose. We're in New Haven. Our guests are Kevin Kane, a musician whose rock career spans 45 years, almost as long as Paul Simon's. Mercy Quay, whose life doesn't even span anything like that. She's director of communications for New Haven Public Schools. And Brian's Francis Slattery, who's the arts editor for the New Haven Independent and a producer at WNHH Radio. We like to end The Nose with just getting all of our interesting panelists to talk about things that they like that maybe you would like too. So Brian, yours and mine kind of go together, but I'm going to have you go first.
Okay. Well, this time I'm ready. Oh. So I can tie everything together too, which is fun. So the first thing would be a book that can tie in both what we just talked about and Paul Simon, which is Derek Walcott's Omeros, which is this epic poem about fishermen in the Caribbean. And it's also based on the Iliad. And it is really good. I spent a summer at one point reading it, and it's one of those, like, you know, you remember it as like, wow, that was a great summer that I read a little bit here. And then the other person is one of the Paul Simon songs that you played. It, you know, made me want to go up and revisit my Thomas Mopfumo records. He's basically sort of like the John Lennon / Elvis Presley / Johnny Cash of Zimbabwe. And he's great.
All right, Mercy, what have you got for us?
Sure. So last time I was here, we were talking about Beyonce's Lemonade, and I'm still paying for my data charges for listening to that album on repeat. And there's an author and a book that I'd like to suggest, Bell Hooks. She has written a book on patriarchy. It's called The Will to Love Men, Masculinity, and something or another. I don't know. But it's a great book. And Bell Hooks, the author, actually did this huge critique of Lemonade and how it is actually anti-feminist. So I'm not telling you my opinion on it, but I think that's definitely something for you to check out. That's it.
All right, Kevin, make a recommendation for us.
And this is my first time, and I'm going to do the dumb one, okay? But since we did Paul Simon the whole time, I'm going to make a recommendation that anybody here check out Jackson Browne and go through his catalog, and so that you can also do a comparative between Jackson Browne and Paul Simon. And then I believe I'm going to go back and maybe get a double major in English Lit. I'm thinking that's probably my next course. Thanks, Colin.
Thanks for coming, Kevin. So I should say, by the way, that Paul Simon sang some of the songs that are on the new album. I think it was last April, maybe, at Battelle Chapel. He has a niece who was a senior at Yale. He came in as, I think, a chub fellow and performed just a few blocks from where we're sitting right now in New Haven. I'm going to make some recommendations from the Paul Simon backlist. At the time that Graceland came out, one of the theories was that his career was languishing. And this was based actually on some albums that I really like a lot. One of them is called One Trick Pony, which is basically the soundtrack to it. Maybe not that great movie, but the album's actually really, really great. I went back and listened to it. In fact, I spent all of Sunday just playing around with Tidal, T-I-D-A-L, the Jay-Z-owned streaming service, which I got because of the Lemonade show that we did, and I've still got it now, and I'm being charged for it,
yikes.
I think. But it's really great. It's really fun to play around with. So One Trick Pony is really great overall. The title track's great. There's a song called Ace in the Hole that's terrific. From the album Hearts and Bones, which is probably the Paul Simon album people like the least, there's a song called Rene and Georges Magritte with their dog After the War. And lastly, I will recommend Thelma. One of the great things about Tidal is that it posts up all the reissues of albums rather than the original ones. So Tidal was not released with Rhythm of the Saints. I mean, Thelma was not released with on Rhythm of the Saints, but it's there on Tidal and lots of other reissues of Rhythm of the Saints. It's a terrific song. I'd never heard it before Sunday. I thought I knew Rhythm of the Saints. Anyway, that's all we have time for. But I do recommend getting Tidal and paying Jay-Z a lot of money and then playing around with it. Thanks to Brian Slattery and Kevin Kane and Mercy Quay. And we'll be back on Monday with The Scramble.